This episode is sponsored by Tinuiti. If your customer is streaming it, then they can measure it. Their patented machine learning tech is the tool for the job. Rethink performance with Tinuiti, the largest independent performance marketing firm across streaming TV and the triopoly of Google, Meta, and Amazon. Find out how at rethinkperformance.com.
This is actual data that has some meat behind it and has some proof of, you know, that, hey, this is real. This is not just directional. And so if we can unify that for the first time, we're really able to give a brand a holistic view of what is working and what isn't.
Hey gang, it's Thursday, January 26th. Listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily, an e-marketer podcast made possible by Tinuiti. I'm Marcus. Today's fact: people who read live longer. A study in the journal Social Science and Medicine discovered that folks who read books live longer than those who don't. Researchers at Yale University found that people who read over 3.5 hours a week lived a nearly two years longer than people who didn't read at all. I wish this was stressed a little more in school. Kids, if you don't read, you'll die soon. That's all they had to say. That's too much. Anyway, today's real topic is a conversation between our very own senior analyst Max Willens and two folks from Tinuiti, practice lead in emerging tech Naresh Prasad, and also associate director of commerce Ali Fields. And they talked all about privacy and first-party data.
Welcome in today to a special episode of the eMarketer podcast. We have two guests today. We're here talking about the Amazon Marketing Cloud, beginning with Naresh Prasad, who is the practice lead of emerging tech at Tinuiti. Naresh, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And with Naresh, we have his colleague, Ali Fields. Ali is an associate director of commerce at Tinuiti. Ali, nice to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks, both of you, for being here. Like I said, we're talking Amazon Marketing Cloud. We're talking clean rooms. We're talking privacy. Maybe just a quick sort of level setting here. I'll throw it as a jump ball. Talk to me a little bit about sort of the prevalence of your clients using their first party data in clean rooms. Is this kind of common practice now? Is this something that people, you know, understand they need to do and they're going to get around to it in 2023? Is this something that remains kind of emergent, Naresh? How kind of prevalent is the practice of brands using their first party data these days?
Yeah, it's in the data clean room context, it's top of mind. But what we haven't really seen is execution there. I think there's a lot of good ideas around the data clean room. You're seeing more and more people talk about it. There hasn't been, up until recently, a viable solution just to jump into. And then when it comes to first-party data, we're still organizing our first-party data as an industry. And I don't think there have been a myriad of solutions in the past with CDPs and data warehouses, also equally important, and that we're looking at. I haven't seen anything really dominate in us as an industry really jump into yet until AMC and the work that Ali's doing with it.
Yeah, Ali, talk to us a little bit about how you're sort of looking at this and how you sort of see AMC sort of distinguishing itself from the competitors. Because as Naresh has said, whether it's starting back with CDPs or the variety of clean room solutions out there, there's options on the table, but it doesn't seem like anything has really been widely embraced. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the distinguishing factor with AMC is that Amazon really has made it a very easy jumping in point. So they've made it low risk for our clients in the way that, one, the information is, the data is free on Amazon's side, right? So you can get your advertising data from Amazon for free. But the other thing is that they actually have it created where, you know, you can connect your own 1P data to it, but you don't have to, right? And that's really the cool part, is that you can do as much or as little with this data as you want. And so it makes it a little less scary, I think, for brands, because they're not overwhelmed by the complexity of this. And, you know, you can work with an agency such as Tinuiti or, you know, in-house, and you can really make it how you want to utilize it. And so it's kind of, for the first time, opening the door to clean rooms in a very easy manner.
So let's get further down to brass tacks. Let's say I'm a brand and I, for whatever reason, have kind of been slow to get my ducks in a row as far as, you know, marshaling all my own first party data in a way that can easily be, you know, brought into a clean room or matched. And I hear that AMC allows me to kind of leverage the data that they're sitting on. How practically would that work?
Yeah. So what they've done is they've made it really easy where anybody that has some SQL knowledge can create a query. And Amazon even has an instructional query library that you can, they've already created these queries. So if you have no code background, really, you can run the basics via the UI. And it's all aggregated data. You don't have to worry about, do I know this customer? Do I not? Right? Because there's no customer data that we're worrying about in the individual level. And so they've made it so that it's literally a copy and paste at the bare minimum, but you can make it, again, as complex as you want. So if you have data scientists in-house, you can give them free rein and they can create some really intricate reports that are going to drive your strategy. But if you're net new, you can literally go into their IQL and say, okay, let me copy this, paste it, and then export to CSV, and you can kind of pivot that and get some of the basics.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit too about the sort of breadth of data that can be sort of brought to bear on campaigns and leverage that Amazon has, either using it as a standalone or potentially married with stuff that a brand brings to the fold. What to you is really stands out about what Amazon has available? So obviously, because of the breadth of their assets and their platform, there's a lot there. But what do you sort of see as being the real differentiating, you know, components there?
I think the real like benefit that you get out of it and that we're seeing brands asking the question of is, one, how do we prove that our upper funnel tactics are working, right? That's always the number one question for brands is like, I'm putting money out there on the DSP, I'm putting money out here on these upper funnel tactics, but it's not showing me conversions. How do I prove that? So that's number one, is that you can actually have proof that, hey, it is influencing conversions overall. And then the next one is, again, for brands that have like a D2C or brick and mortar, maybe you can actually look at your customers on that D2C site or the brick and mortar and say, you know, what is the halo of that with my Amazon customers? Are they the same? Are they different? How should we be interacting with them? How do we get more that look like them or that don't in some cases, right? And so you can really build whole strategy around it with really basic knowledge once you kind of get that piece set up.
And is this something to what you guys were talking about earlier, both of you? Obviously, the market as a whole, the industry as a whole sort of understands that this is where everything is going, that there is this ability to potentially with the right partners sort of connect the dots and really maintain a clean through line through the customer journey. But is there sort of that ability to understand how those dots are connected at the client level? Or are you guys still in the process often of kind of educating clients on how to sort of, you know, trace those lines using this data, especially when it comes to upper funnel spending?
Yeah, I'll pass to Ali, but I'll answer the first part. I think we're still at a stage where there's a lot of education necessary of how even the old way worked and how marketing used to work and the signals that we've lost. I do think there's an over-reliance on the dashboards we're already in. And we're just trusting what we have. And there is this need to build out something holistically to the point that Max and Ali were making. How do we get there? It is this investment in tools like this. And we just haven't gotten there because we're still used to what we're familiar with. And I think that's working against us as we move forward and just do privacy by default paradigm.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of work to be done and we're still kind of connecting the dots there. I think the vision and what is really cool and intrigues me about all of this is that especially on, you know, kind of the e-commerce world, typically brands have different teams responsible, right, for each retailer or each product or however they set it up. And clean rooms, the idea behind it, right, is that we could actually, if they get to a unified point where multiple retailers, you know, different companies can unify the data in one clean room, then we can actually connect the whole story really for the first time. Because, you know, you have your, like Naresh was saying, you have your data signals that we're relying on. Those were directional, right? At best, we know that. And this is actual data that has some meat behind it and has some proof of, you know, that, hey, this is real. This is not just directional. And so if we can unify that for the first time, we're really able to give a brand a holistic view of what is working and what isn't.
So on that point, I want to talk about the privacy-shaped elephant in the room and get your thoughts on sort of what the implications are for all of this technology that, again, potentially allows for really comprehensive view of customer journey and behavior. How do you sort of think this through or counsel clients on how this works? Because I could see versions of this where if it's not done in a responsible way, it creates a pretty powerful potential for creepiness. Mm-hmm. Just talk to me a little bit about sort of what you see there and what the state of play is and how you sort of walk a client through how that all works.
Yeah, we start by just the foundational knowledge of what's happening in privacy. And just reiterating, the environment continues to change. And we have two sides. We have the regulatory environment where we have, you know, 5 states this year, 4 with new privacy laws, 1 with a new one. And just going through that audit and really getting them to understand what they can and can't do with their data and how they need to be able to communicate what they need from their clients and what they can do with their own data. And the other side is, I think there's not a great education out there, even though we know cookies are going away and our tracking's impacting us. I don't think it's great education all the ways that we've been impacted. It's not just that cookies are going away. Tracking's been impacted in multiple ways and in ways that we don't always think about. Apple's operating system has removed signals. We don't always think of it that way because I think we end up investing in what are people doing on desktop? What are they doing in Chrome when half the internet is using Safari and those signals are already gone? So educating there becomes really important. Talking to teams about the concept of a clean room is exciting because you're not copying data, you're not moving it. That's interesting. When we think about what data systems need to look like in the future, that's important. We can't copy it. We can't move it. Clean rooms become really important there. And that's the problem with some of the older systems that we were using to unite data and make it. We were copying that data. And that creates another problem just in on internal teams and being able to share that widely. So we're posing these questions, getting brands and our teams to also think through those problems. And our hope is we arrive at solutions like a clean room that help us to continue doing marketing. How does marketing work in the future if we can't measure it? It won't. We'll just be kind of throwing darts at the board. And that's what we're trying to figure out today.
Yeah, the throwing darts at the board is a powerful image there. I guess final question before I let you both go. I mean, we've talked a lot about how this is a possible advantage and opportunity for brands of lots of different shapes and sizes, but there's still a lot of education, still a lot of, you know, preparing. What do you guys find is maybe the thing that's most likely to kind of, you know, break the inertia on the client side, especially because the thing that we all kind of expected might force lots of people to do this, which is the cookie deprecation, keeps getting pushed back. But what do you sort of see being the thing that most commonly kind of gets people into gear that you expect to see more of in 2023?
This is not the answer I like giving, but I think more things have to break.
Yeah, I would agree. I think more things have to break. And I think that more, like we're seeing the walled gardens, right? Amazon and Google and Meta and all that, like they need to be providing this data more freely because that's going to garner the interest and get, you know, the appetite going.
I think that's right. Brands are going to play with a toy until you take it away. So I guess we'll have to look forward to the toys getting taken away in many months. Thank you both very much. I enjoyed the conversation. It was good talking to you both.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for today's lead. It's time for the second half of the show that Max is sticking around to help me with. It's been a while since we did this segment, first one of the year. Today, in other news, why Meta's recent GDPR violation could threaten its ad duopoly status, and Twitter reportedly loses over 500 of its top advertisers. Story one, Meta's over $400 million GDPR violation, that's General Data Protection Regulation violation, could threaten its ad duopoly status, writes Insider Intelligence Briefing's analyst Daniel Konstantinovich. He notes that EU regulators hit Meta with this fine, which was based on a 2018 complaint about its policy requiring users to opt into personalized ads to use Facebook and Instagram, its owned platforms. This violates the GDPR rules. Daniel says that if the ruling stands, Meta will no longer be able to require users to accept personalized ads, and we could see an app tracking transparency like opt-out system being introduced to Meta's platforms, similar to what Apple has. Meta has 3 months to change how it obtains and uses data to target ads. The company does plan to appeal the decision. But Max, the most interesting sentence in this article is what and why?
Well, it's a sentence that you read already from Daniel's punchy article. It's the idea that this could potentially lead to an ATT-like opt-out system being introduced on Meta's platforms. That is, I don't think it's exaggerating to say that that potentially breaks the one of the key advantages that social platforms have again, it's years away from them changing this, but I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could see platforms like Meta and others experiment with using a really unpleasant ad experience on people that don't opt in as a kind of cudgel to get people to opt in.
Mm-hmm. Story two.
Twitter loses more than 500 of its top advertisers in 3 months, writes Daniel in a separate briefings article. According to the information, who spoke with senior managers in the 3 months since Elon Musk took over as head of Twitter, over 500 of its top advertisers have stopped spending on the platform. Senior folks also mentioned that Q4 revenues were down over 30%, with Q1 not looking much better. But Max, the most interesting sentence in this article is what and why.
I'm going to bend the rules a little here and pull out.
Already?
I know. It's okay. I'm that guy. but it's in that the key thing here is the data point of 500 advertisers leaving, being associated with a 30% drop in revenue. This to me is really important because it shows how reliant Twitter is on its top advertisers versus a platform like Facebook or Instagram, which is powerful primarily because it has this enormous long tail of advertisers who spend with them every single month. When there was the big Facebook boycott that happened in 2020, it involved a lot of its quote unquote top advertisers, but it barely dented Meta's ratings. And I think the comparison between that and Twitter is powerful and important. It shows that Twitter needs to get its act together quickly if it wants those people back.
Yeah. No, it's an excellent point. Two things that jumped out to me from Daniel's article was one was we adjusted our 2022 US Twitter ad revenue forecast in November down to $4.7 billion. That's a cut of $1 billion from our March forecast. So we revised Twitter's ad revenues down as a result of everything that's going on. And two, we now expect Twitter to lose users worldwide this year. That's a first. Twitter to lose users worldwide this year. Last year, we had them adding 6 million worldwide users. This year, we expect Twitter to lose 15 million. So it's going to lose three times as many as it added last year, reaching a very pivotal point in terms of user growth, according to our forecast. That's all we've got time for. Thank you so much, Max, for hanging out today.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
And thank you to Ali and Naresh, who joined us in the first half of the show from Tinuity. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show. Thanks to James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. And thanks to everyone listening in. We will see you tomorrow, hopefully, for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen, which Max will also join us for, along with Rahul and Oscar. That's an eMarketer podcast made possible by Tinuity.